The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to feature stories about museums, three museums to be specific. Our first story is headlined, North Carolina Museum of Art Races to Finish Reimagination. Now, this article appeared in the August 9th, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. Writer Kayla Guo highlights some special exhibits visitors will want to see once the museum is fully reopened in October. So plan your visit now. You ready? In October, on the 75th anniversary of the state legislature dedicating funds to build the People's Collection, the North Carolina Museum of Art will unveil a completely reimagined collection. It will feature new thematic and interpretive galleries, plus numerous special commissions, loans, and newly acquired works. It's the first major reinstallation of the People's Collection since 2010. The reorganization aims to challenge how art has traditionally been presented in museums according to geography and chronology, which can sideline or exclude works from historically marginalized groups. Instead, the new exhibition aims to draw connections between art across time and place to expand the narratives and representations on display and to increase the accessibility of art and the museum. The driving force and directive is to present what we see as a much more expanded and inclusive narrative, and I would also underscore a more accurate narrative, Chief Curator Linda Doherty said. This shift places the North Carolina Art Museum within a larger transformation in the museum world as a younger generation of curators comes into the field and takes on historical practices and interpretations of art history that have served to exclude or devalue certain artists and groups, Doherty said. For director Valerie Hillings, the reinstallation represents a signature project to really change the stories that could be told through the collection. The project first began when she received a grant from the Mellon Foundation at the start of her directorship in 2018. The whole goal here, really, is to remind North Carolinians that everything here belongs to the people of North Carolina. It's the people's collection, Hillings said. And so our hope is that through all of our different channels, we'll get information about the collection outside the walls. The museum's west building has been closed to the public since the end of May, and much of the east building has been closed since January. The museum will fully reopen with a series of events October 8th and 9th. In our next section, Made in Americas and Other New Galleries, five new themed galleries will be presented as part of the reinstallation. They will focus on portraits and power, Egypt and Africa, the Americas, art conservation, and interdisciplinary and multimedia art. The galleries are organized in a way in which we pick an idea and we take work from every part of the collection to tell that story, Doherty said, gesturing to a sprawling-to-scale model of the West Building filled with miniature art and post-it notes. The curators call the model the dollhouse and use it to plan the reinstallation. Made in Americas, for instance, will integrate the collection's ancient American and American art to illustrate their relationships with each other and the wider world. The Africa We Ought to Know will bring together the collection's Egyptian and African works where they had previously been separated, celebrating that Africa is a continent where empires have flourished over millennia, each contributing to a fascinating antiquity and a vigorous history that extends to a dynamic and creative present, according to a museum press release. There are ideas and themes and narratives that appear in art across the centuries and all over the world, and we want to draw your attention to all these ideas that we hold in common, Doherty said. The reorganization means that certain exhibits will be moved to new locations in the museum. The Judaic art collection, for example, will sit in the middle of the European collection to situate it within a European and religious context. Context really impacts how you view a work of art, Doherty said. I always say you can move a painting from one gallery to another and view it in a completely different way because of the conversations it has with the other work. What to expect, or what else to expect? 5 site-specific commissions, including a new permanent installation by Argentinian artist Tomás Saraceno, and year-long displays by Moroccan artist Hassan Haji, and North Carolinians Elizabeth Alexander and J.P. Germain Powell will also go on view for the first time. The collection will introduce newly acquired works from indigenous sculptor Marie Watt, North Carolinian India Beale, South African multimedia artist William Kentridge, African-American and indigenous artist Edmonia Lewis, and more. Around 100 loaned works will join the collection for museums, including the National Gallery of Art, the Rijksmuseum Museum in Amsterdam, the Acklin Art Museum in Chapel Hill, and the Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center in Asheville. The reinstallation will also introduce a community voices program in which commentary from 20 North Carolinians will appear in conversation with labels written by curators on different objects in the collection. The Community Voices program, which will include artists, students, civic leaders, journalists, and food activists, intends to further the museum's goal of connecting to our public and to our visitors, Hilling said. The way a curator talks about a work of art is often very different from some of the other, what the general public sees and says, and why they like something and why they react to it. In addition to expand the accessibility of the museum and its collection, wall text in the reinstallation will be translated in both English and Spanish, and QR codes will appear throughout the galleries to provide visitors with more information and context. The museum is also clear that there will be no one way to experience the collection. Instead, the curators hope the collection will elicit or can elicit some visual curiosity and resonance with viewers and their own everyday lives. We're just trying to loosen it up so that the visitor can choose and is offered different layers of being able to approach it, Helene said. We'll continue to look at the collection, evaluate what would be interesting to change, and keep responding to the audience and how the world is changing. A race to the finish is our final section. 2 months out from the reopening, the West Building is still filled with light and artwork. Many of the building's white walls are marked with paper placeholders instead of the paintings they represent. Rodin sculptures stand on their platforms wrapped in protective plastic, and the sound of drilling echoes through the lobby. An enormous commission stands partly finished, with its various elements on standby as the artist works on site to complete it. The museum is on track to complete the reinstallation in time for its opening, but it's a race to the finish as the curators put final touches on the galleries and the teams on the ground carry out the reorganization of more than 1,000 pieces of art. Ian Larson, the museum's chief art handler, and his team have orchestrated thousands of art movements for the reinstallation. Director of Collections and Exhibitions Management Megan Olis coordinates the scheduling of all those maneuvers to ensure that when a work has to be moved, it has an open place to land. And Maggie Gregory, Manager of Collections and Head Registrar, has been keeping a close eye on each of the works to make sure none are lost in the shuffle. It's a lot like playing a puzzle game, Ola said, about coordinating the reinstallation. It's a heck of a schedule. And while the teams are well on their way to completing the reinstallation, Ola noted that supply chain issues and staff shortages due to the pandemic have slowed the process. It takes a village to do a reshuffle like this, Larson said. The art handling team members 6. It's a great way to learn the collection because I'll literally have had hands-on on every single piece of art the museum owns by the time the reinstallation is finished, he added. These kinds of big projects will either make or break a team, and for us it's really brought everyone together, Olis said. I'm looking forward to the finished product and being able to walk around and be proud of how hard we worked. In the meantime, visitors can view Becoming the NCMA, 10 Decades of Collecting, 1924 to 2022. It's in the East Building and will be there until August 21st, so obviously that's passed. And outlandish photographs by Ralph Burns, photographs from the collection of Alan G. Thomas, Jr., will be on display until February 12th. So there you go. Something new coming. And so think about visiting the North Carolina Museum of Art after the first week of October, and you can see all of the art museum and its many offerings. Wow. Next, we're going to travel to New England to learn why Native Americans urge boycott of Tone-Deaf Pilgrim Museum. Associated Press writer Philip Marcello's article focuses on the Plymouth Patuxent Museums. The story appeared in the August 7, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. Native Americans in Massachusetts are calling for a boycott of a popular living history museum featuring colonial reenactors portraying life in Plymouth, the famous English settlement founded by the Pilgrims who arrived on the Mayflower. Members of the state's Wampanoag Noag community and their supporters say Plymouth Patuxent Museums has not lived up to its promise of creating a bicultural museum that equally tells the story of the Europeans and indigenous peoples that lived there. They say the historic Patuxent home site, the portion of the mostly outdoor museum focused on traditional indigenous life, is inadequately small, in need of repairs, and staffed by workers who aren't from local tribes. We're saying don't patronize them, don't work over there, said Camille Madison, a member of the Aquana Wampanoag tribe on Martha's Vineyard, who was among those recently venting their frustrations on social media. We don't want to engage with them until they can find a way to respect indigenous knowledge and experience. The concerns come just 2 years after the museum changed its name from Plymouth Plantation to Plymouth Patuxent as part of a year-long celebration of the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower landing. At the time, the museum declared the new, more balanced moniker reflected the importance of the indigenous perspective to the 75-year-old institution's educational mission. Patuxent was an indigenous community near Plymouth, and it was spelled back then in the early days as P-L-I-M-O-T-H, as the Pilgrim colony was known before becoming modern-day Plymouth, P-L-Y-M-O-U-T-H. It was badly decimated by European diseases by the time the Mayflower arrived, but one of its survivors, Tisquantum, commonly known as Squanto, famously helped the English colonists survive the first winter. They've changed the name, but haven't changed the attitude, said Paula Peters, a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, who worked for nearly 20 years at the museum, most recently as marketing director. They've done nothing to ingratiate themselves with tribes. Every step they take is tone deaf, she said. Museum spokesperson Rob Cluen, in a statement emailed to the Associated Press, said the museum has expanded the outdoor Wampanoag exhibit, raised more than $2 million towards new indigenous programs building, and has several initiatives in place to recruit and retain staff from Native communities. He declined to elaborate. The statement also cited a pair of grants the museum received to boost its Native American education programming. That included more than $160 from the National Endowment for the Humanities to host a workshop this summer for teachers on how to incorporate indigenous voices into their history lessons. The museum also noted that its new director of Algonquian exhibits and interpretation is an Aquina Wampanoag who serves on his tribe's educational committee. Carol Pollard, whose late brother Anthony Nashpashamanet Pollard played a key role in the development of the museum's indigenous programming as a leading Wampanoag historian, was among those displayed at the state site. Last week, large gaps were evident in the battered tree bark roof on the large wetu, or traditional Wampanoag dwelling, that is a focal point of the indigenous exhibit. Neither of the two museums' interpreters on site was wearing traditional tribal attire. Meanwhile, on the Pilgrim settlement part of the museum, thatched roofs on the colonial homes had been recently repaired, and numerous reenactors milled about in detailed period outfits. I know my brother would be very disappointed, said Pollard, who also worked as a gardener at the museum until last summer. I guarantee you people dressed in khakis and navy blue tops was not my brother's vision. Former museum staffers say museum officials for years ignored their suggestions for modernizing and expanding the outdoor exhibit, which marks its 50th anniversary next year. That, coupled with low pay and poor working conditions, led to the departure of many long-standing Native staffers who built the program into a must-see attraction by showcasing authentic indigenous farming, cooking, canoe building, and other cultural practices, they say. For more than a decade now, the museum has systematically dismantled the outdoor exhibit. The Wampanoag Consulting Alliance, a native group that includes Peters and other former museum staffers, said in a statement last month. Many steps taken to provide equal representation to Wampanoag programming have been removed, and the physical exhibit is in deplorable condition. The result has been the virtually complete alienation of the Wampanoag communities. Kitty Hendricks Miller, a Mashpee Wampanoag who was supervisor at the Wampanoag exhibit in the 1990s and early 2000s, says she worries about what non-Indigenous families and students are taking away from their visits to the museum, which remains a school field trip rite of passage for many in New England. As Indian education coordinator for her tribe, she's been encouraging teachers to reach out to Native communities directly if they're seeking culturally and historically accurate programs. There's this unwillingness to acknowledge that times have changed, said Casey Figueroa, who worked for years as an interpreter at the museum until 2015. The Native side of the Plymouth story has so much more to offer in terms of the issues we're facing today, from immigration to racism and climate change, but they went backwards instead. They totally blew it. Well, our third museum is found in Oklahoma. It's been in the making for several years, but only opened this year. The story goes back to May 2022 and first appeared in the Washington Post. It was reprinted in the online edition of the News and Observer on May 8th of this year. The writer, Annie Gowan. The headline, at 80, Bob Dylan finally gets a museum. Dateline, Tulsa, Oklahoma. True to form, Bob Dylan was nowhere to be found as construction crew put the finishing touches on his museum this week, and that would have been the week of May 1st. The smell of fresh lumber lingered in the air, the fire marshal was checking emergency sprinklers, and workers were setting up a jukebox with Dylan's greatest hits in lieu of the reclusive genius himself. A new museum and archive dedicated to Dylan and his work is set to open in Tulsa this month, and again, that was in May, the culmination of a six-year journey that began when local banking and oil billionaire George Kaiser's foundation bought Dylan's voluminous personal archive and pledged to create a home for it. When the center opens on Tuesday, and that was May 12th, the public will for the first time be able to see some of the more than 100,000 items in Dylan's personal archive, including multiple song drafts, rare recordings and videos, and historic such artifacts as the battered Turkish drum that inspired the classic song Mr. Tambourine Man. It promises a historic look into the creative engine that has driven the singer's 60-year career. Organizers hope the 29,000-square-foot, $10 million center will become a cultural touchstone in Tulsa, offering both fans and hardcore Dylanologists a greater understanding of the famously enigmatic and guarded musician who at age 80 is widely considered the country's greatest living artist. The scope of the material and its impact is almost without equal, said Stephen Jenkins, the Dylan Center's director. But we have no intention of trying to explain the Bob Dylan mystery. No matter how hard we try, the man at the core of this all somehow continues to remain elusive. Historian Douglas Brinkley, a patron of the center, said it will provide a deeper understanding of the artist's body of work at a time when there has been a resurgence of interest in Dylan, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2016 for creating new poetic expressions within the great American song tradition. The Nobel Prize caused skeptics, those who didn't like Dylan's voice or thought his artistry was only related to folk rock and roll, to wake up and realize he's one of our greatest literary masters, a national treasure, Brinkley said. He's one of those artists like Louis Armstrong, Hank Williams, or Woody Guthrie, who embodies the rest of the American the best of the American spirit and is loved around the world. A mural of Dylan's moody visage from a 1965 photo now soars above the Tulsa Arts District on the site of an old brick warehouse complex that also houses the Museum of Guthrie, the Oklahoma folk singer who was Dylan's early musical hero. The Dylan Center's foyer is marked by a playful gate, a 16-foot swirl of cast iron cast-offs, and mechanical implements that Dylan welded and gave to the center, one of several non-musical artworks he has exhibited in recent years. In a wink to the city hosting his museum, he used a salvaged iron piece marked Tulsa, Oklahoma. In the main gallery, Dylan's life is portrayed chronologically on the walls, with photos, reproduced concert bills, and album covers showcasing his life, from his birth in 1941 in Duluth, Minnesota, to his current status as Nobel laureate, a traveling troubadour who is still on the road, as the exhibit puts it. Listeners with audio guides can stop to hear key performances, such as from his 1966 tour of Europe, when he scandalized some acoustic-loving fans by bringing out an electric guitar. Visitors can also listen to Dylan's early influences, such as Little Richard at the listening stations, or remix some of his famous tracks in a mock recording studio. Six concrete pillars showcase Dylan's works, such as The Tangled Up in Blue and Like a Rolling Stone, where fans can follow the songwriting from first spark to the album release. As Dylan quote in the Century was the key inspiration for the project, according to Stephen Willits, a Dylan biographer who helped shape the bio wall. It reads, "Life isn't about finding yourself or finding anything. Life is about creating yourself and creating things." The Tangled Up in Blue exhibit shows the lengths to which Dylan labors over a long song, rewriting lyrics again and again, years after he first put pen to paper and desponded over the failure of his first marriage. Viewers can listen to an early version so intimate and spare that it sounds like a diary entry. And then there are the Blood Notebooks, which Archives director Mark Davidson called the collection's crown jewels. For decades, Dylan scholars traded rumors over the existence of a little red notebook, which scribbled lyrics from the album Blood on the Tracks that few have ever seen. Rolling Stone dubbed it the Maltese Falcon of Dylanology. Believed to have been stolen from the singer decades ago, it eventually surfaced and made its way to the Morgan Library and Museum in New York. When Dylan's archive was purchased in 2016, scholars discovered two other tiny notebooks that also contained draft lyrics from the 1975 album and persuaded the Morgan Library to send the red one to Tulsa under heavy security. All three are now on display together for the first time. They show Dylan in an incredibly strong point in his songwriting career, Davidson said. It's writing in these little pocket notebooks microscopically, frantically. It's as much of sort of an unconscious brain dump as you can get. A small reading nook rounds out the first floor, with books curated by Joy Harjo, the U.S. Poet Laureate and a Tulsa native, who will be the center's first artist in residence. Upstairs, there is a private area for scholars and a public viewing gallery for key projects from the archive, such as the famous tambourine, which is really a Turkish drum. Sean Latham, a University of Tulsa English professor who oversees the school's Institute for Bob Dylan Studies, said his favorite item is an unopened sack of fan mail that had lain moldering and forgotten for years in the singer's house in Woodstock, New York. Latham and his graduate students have been opening and cataloging the letters, which were written in 1966, shortly after Dylan had a motorcycle accident and stopped touring for 8 years. It's a time capsule of a time when Dylan was one of the world's most famous rock stars and an astonishing look at what his fandom looked like at this pivotal moment, Latham said. His team found plenty of letters smeared with teeny bopper lipstick, now a half-century old, but also a poignant letter from a machine gunner in Vietnam who had lost three friends in combat. The soldier loved the song Blowin' in the Wind, he wrote. "We've been in this blood-drenched country for 5 months," the soldier wrote. "I want to live so bad, just want to see and touch my family and friends again." Davidson is still trying to find the man to determine whether he survived. In September 2014, a tempting email arrived in the inbox of Ken Levitt, the executive director of Tulsa's George Kaiser Family Foundation, the philanthropy of a low-key local billionaire that had expanded its programs from early childhood education and development to the arts and creating public spaces. The note was from a rare book dealer in New York, whom Levitt had worked with when the foundation purchased Woody Guthrie's archives from the folk singer's surviving children in 2011 and brought them back to Oklahoma, not far from the town of Okama, where Guthrie was born. He said, "I've got a set of materials of global significance. You need to call me back, Leavitt recalled. I figured it was either the Beatles or Dylan. As Leavitt described it, Dylan and his staff had seen how the foundation built a museum and center in downtown Tulsa around Guthrie's archives, thousands of scraps of paper, song notes, drawings, and diaries. They hoped they could do the same for Dylan's personal collection. Dylan had been an early acolyte of Guthrie, who was a pioneer of American folk music. He memorized all of Guthrie's songs as a young man. After he moved to New York, Dylan often visited his icon in the hospital, where Guthrie was slowly dying of a degenerative nerve disease. Dylan would bring his guitar and sing Guthrie's songs to him. So despite his scant connection to Tulsa, Dylan said, it made a lot of sense to sell his archives to the foundation that built the Woody Guthrie Center when the $20 million deal was announced in 2016. There's more vibrations on the coast for sure, Dylan told Brinkley in an April 21st column for Vanity Fair, referring to his decision to choose Tulsa over more obvious choices such as his home state or near his home in Malibu. But I'm from Minnesota, and I like the casual hum of the heartland. Civic leaders hope the Bob Dylan and Woody Guthrie Centers fuel an ongoing cultural renaissance in a metro area of 1 million people, with side-by-side archives transforming Tulsa into an emerging hub for the study of American music. The State Historical Society plans to open a museum devoted to Oklahoma pop culture and country music next year. And a local business executive, Teresa Knox, recently restored the historic church studio, a recording studio once owned by Native Son and musician Leon Russell, where Tom Petty signed his first record deal. The blues musician Taj Mahal and the Celtic punk band Dropkick Murphys are among contemporary artists who have dropped by to record. Tulsa has always been a crossroads. Now it's going to be a crossroads for Americana culture, Brinkley said. When Dylan came to Tulsa for the concert last month, which would have been April 2022, he did not visit the center being created in his honor, although his longtime bassist, Tony Garnier, did stop by. Nostalgia is not his thing, Brinkley said. The Bob Dylan Center was set to be inaugurated with concerts from his longtime friends and collaborators, Patti Smith and Elvis Costello, the weekend of May 14th and 15th. An avid baseball fan, Dylan instead made time to quietly attend the season opener for the Tulsa Drillers, the town's minor league baseball team, according to Brinkley. The next night, he hung a Drillers pennant on his piano before he sat down to play. The stage was nearly bare, save the upright piano facing the audience and two bright lamps. Along with VIP guests such as Olivia Harrison, the wife of the late George Harrison, many locals who worked on the Dylan Center looked on in rapt attention. Those in the closer-up seats could only see a tendril of his curly hair sticking out above the instrument. It was this disembodied voice of age and experience acting like an oracle from behind those lights on stage, said Latham. I loved it. Dylan, who will turn 81 in May, ended with a haunting performance of Every Grain of Sand, his 1981 song about a man grappling with faith and mortality. Onward in my journey, I came to understand that every hair is numbered, like every grain of sand. So the Bob Dylan Museum, Tulsa, Oklahoma, make that your next stop. Wow. Hope you've enjoyed today's journey and some visits to some unusual museums. That brings us to the end of our today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it, and you'll join us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And by the way, Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at the website ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.